You know, it's really too bad when some Greek words are transliterated into English words that sound enough like completely unrelated English words that we go overboard with our eisegesis, which is a fancy word for reading stuff into the Bible that isn't there, something we all do. This week we will be talking about the Greek word talanta, transliterated, to talents. Of course, talanta was a 75-pound measure of something like gold or silver, but in English, talent obviously means an ability, which really completely obscures the meaning of this parable and subverts how it would have been read by Yeshua's, or you may call him Jesus's, first century audience. Hi, I'm Tyler Dawn Rosenquist, and welcome to Character in Context, where we explore the historical context of Scripture and talk about how it bears on our own behavior and witness as God's image bearers. You can find my other teachings on my websites, theancientbridge.com and contextforkids.com, as well as on my YouTube channels, accessible from my websites. You can also access past broadcasts of this show on my podcast channel, characterincontext.podbean.com, which also links to my iTunes channel. And my context books for adults and families are available through amazon.com. So this is part 4 of my series on the readiness parables of Matthew chapters 24 and 25, talking about how we are supposed to stay awake, and when read as a group and in context with the ancient world, and actually just in context with each other. And yeah, it reads a lot differently than a lot of people want to emphasize, okay? And this one is a huge one because, you know, in the ancient world, they weren't capitalists. You know, and we read the parable of the talents so much with our own cultures. This is going to be kind of weird. It's not going to entirely change the meaning, but it's really going to give you a different view of Yeshua's audience. So I hope that this is going to be edifying for you. So let's get to this, and we're going to be reading from Matthew 25, starting in verse 14. For it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted to them his property. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, to each according to his ability. Then he went away. He who had received the 5 talents went at once and traded with them. And he made 5 talents more. So also he who had the 2 talents made 2 talents more. But he who had received the 1 talent went and dug in the ground and hid his master's money. Now after a long time, the master of those servants came and settled accounts with them. And he who had received the 5 talents came forward, bringing 5 talents more, saying, Master, you delivered to me 5 talents. Here! I have made 5 talents more. His master said to him, Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. And he also who had made the 2 talents came forward, saying, Master, you delivered to me 2 talents. Here, I have made 2 talents more. His master said to him, Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. He also, who had received the 1 talent, came forward saying, Master, I knew you were a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. So I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here, you have what is yours. But his master answered him, You wicked and slothful servant. You knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I scattered no seed? then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers. And at my coming, I should have received what was my own with interest. So take the talent from him and give it to him who has the 10 talents. To everyone who has will be given more, and he will have an abundance. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. And cast the worthless servant into the outer darkness, in that place where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Okay, so in the first part of this series, we talked about the ancient meaning of outer darkness and the weeping and gnashing of teeth. Not in terms of hell, all right, but in terms of rejection, because all of these four parables, they are all just riddled with rejection language. And in that first teaching, I talked about how there was nothing worse in the ancient world than rejection. They're not like us at all. We think we can get along without other people, but we think we can get along as we have, you know, our comforts and our internet and, you know, our books and all that sort of things. And so, yeah, supermarkets, we can't really get along without other people. We just like to fool ourselves that we can. But in the ancient world, being rejected was a matter of life or death. So they saw this very differently. But anyway, I'm not going to go over that. So, you know, like the first parable in this series that we talked, the parable of the faithful steward, and possibly the second, the parable of the 10 virgins, we're talking about household servants again this week, which is very important to understanding the gist of this teaching. Now, when you read servants, which is how doulos is translated, I don't want you thinking either of The Help, which was an awesome book that I highly recommend, by the way, or Roots, all right? Neither of those reflect the reality of Roman-era slavery, where slaves were actually considered members of the household and were often trusted with, you know, enormous responsibility. They were often educated and even worked as civil servants or artisans who drew a salary and didn't just labor for nothing, and who could expect to be freed when they reached a certain age, often 30 years old. Once freed, they remained part of the extended household of their former owners and could even become Roman citizens. You know, it wasn't based on ethnicity, okay, on color, but generally impoverished or conquered people became slaves, and they were generally much better off and wealthier than non-slaves. That being said, a Roman slave owner could have his slave crucified on a whim, so I'm not painting a glorious picture of sunshine and roses here. Given the choice between American, European, and modern-day Islamic slavery and the Roman sort, though, I would want to be a slave in the Roman Empire without even having to think about it. And not just because I'm 50 and would have long since been let loose. So, we have slaves here and not paid servants who come and go and already have their freedom. Also, we need to discuss the zero-sum economy of the ancient world. I have talked about this briefly before. In a world without big trucks, filled with stuff, constantly being delivered to local supermarkets, and money being printed all the time, in the ancient world, there was only so much stuff to go around, and when it was gone or completely distributed, it was just gone. That was it. And I liken it to a turkey pepperoni pizza with extra cheese. That's what I like. With stuffed crust. Let's go for it here. And you've got pizza, and it's sliced into 10 slices. And there are 4 people at the meeting. All right. And you've got the boss and his 3 employees. Well, you know, if this was an equitable system, which it wasn't in the ancient world, each one would be given like 2.5 slices of pizza. You know what? Let's make it, We'll just go with this. I'm going to have to mess up the math here. Each one would get 2.5 slices of pizza. But in the ancient world, no, it was more like each of the three employees gets 2 slices of pizza each. And the boss gets 4 slices. And they wouldn't have thought that was unfair. They would have just said, well, he has more honor than we do. Yeah, of course he gets more pizza than we do. And then all the slices of pizza are gone. But what if Frank's a little bit late to the meeting and Joe takes his slices? So Joe now also gets 4 slices. Okay, so Frank, or whatever I said his name was, well, he's going to go hungry. He's going to get 0. And in this sort of scenario, there's no Pizza Hut. There's no more pizza. There will never be any more pizza. Frank is now going to go hungry. And Joe's, you know, stuffing his face, but the other employees would be looking at Joe like a thief, taking what didn't belong to him, oppressing Frank. That's a zero-sum economy, okay? Anyway, so the only way to get more in the ancient world was to do it honestly through agriculture, or dishonestly through graft, corruption, charging interest, oppressing others, and generally getting more at the expense of others, because you can't get more unless you took it from somebody else, like the pizza. Also, it was the job of any slave to represent his master's interest, regardless of whether or not he agreed with him. To not faithfully image your master, you know, okay, to be an image bearer was not to be... To not faithfully image your master was to not be a good servant, to not represent him accurately in the community. It doesn't matter what the slave's values are to his master. He is to faithfully and diligently endure to in his job and do the desires of his master. So in this parable, we're going to be dealing with the topics of trust, aka pistis, image bearing, zero-sum economies, slavery, and ancient peasant attitudes about profiteering. And how this parable reads is, to us, is the exact opposite of how it read to them, which makes this a lot of fun. However, the end game is the same. So we'll get to there. So far, we've covered the importance of living lives of In this series, living lives of preparedness by having the kind of character that does not abuse or oppress, but instead cares for others as though Yeshua is actually returning. In the parable, the faithful steward, he just had to, you had two people and they had to make choices about how they were going to live. Were they going to live like their master was coming home at any time, or were they going to live like he was never coming back? We also have the importance of living faithful lives of patience and endurance and planning for the wait for his return to be a long time coming. This one is going to be much more pointed as to what is expected to us in terms of behavior, even though the parable seems to direct us to do the opposite from the point of view of the original audience. Now, next week, after when we talk about the parable, the sheep and the goats, there will be no more guesswork about how to represent our king publicly and privately until his return, or in the words of Yeshua, how to be therefore ready. Okay. And as he said in Matthew chapter 4, verse 44, therefore you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. All right. Now let's get to the parable here, and like last week, we're going to go through it in small bits to pick up the context and what is and is not being said. All righty then. Starting in verse 14, for it will be like a man going on a journey, who called his servants and entrusted them to his property. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, to each according to his ability. Then he went away. So here we have a man who is the head of a very wealthy household. Why do I say wealthy? Well, he has 8 talents that he can just hand out to his servants. As I mentioned at the beginning, a talent is roughly 75 pounds of something, in this case, probably silver. We do see gold talents being referenced with respect to the construction of the tabernacle, and specifically with regard to the furnishings of the holy place and the Holy of Holies. The gold menorah and its utensils were crafted out of a full talent of pure gold. 75 pounds of pure gold. I mean, just like, dang, right? Now, in the first century, in the context of this parable, we would be dealing with currency here that could be worked with, and so it almost has to be silver. In today's market, 1 talent of silver would be worth $16,231.25 as of the day that I am recording this, and 5 would be worth $81,156.25. And the master just gives his slave the cash and goes away. Are you thinking what I'm thinking? Freedom! Oh my gosh. Hand a slave over 80K and say goodbye. But this was the first century, and slaves who would be given that sort of money would be trusted household retainers like Joseph, who we talked about in the parable of the faithful steward. These aren't shifty characters that aren't to be trusted by their master. These guys are all trusted. I don't know about you, but no one has ever handed me anywhere near that much money before. But each was trusted with the money according to his abilities. That's what it says. No one was given more than he had the ability to work with. The levels were according to what they could and could not reasonably be expected to do. And just like that, the master just bolts, okay? Hands out. Oh, I should have looked. It's something like $125,000 worth of silver, and then he just leaves. No say in what he's going to come back or anything like that. So next step of the thing here. Now he who had received the 5 talents went at once, and he traded with them. And he made 5 talents more. So also he who had dug the 2 talents, or he who had the 2 talents made 2 talents more. But he who had received the 1 talent went and dug in the ground and hid his master's money. Now, at this point, Yeshua's audience had a real clear picture about who was the bad guy and who was the good guy in this parable. But it isn't who we would expect. The guy with the 81K just went out and somehow got 81K more. And where exactly did he get it from? Probably the people who were already poor. But however he got it, it meant that someone else didn't have it anymore. So the guy with the 10 talents is a real jerk in the eyes of Yeshua's audience. And they'd be frowning at this point because that's a lot of money to take from a peasant population. Then came the guy with 32K, and he also went and got more money. Probably from them by loaning money to them and then charging excessive interest, even though it was forbidden, and then taking their land away. Now here are 2 bad guys who have finagled and schemed and acted dishonestly and robbed people like them of $113,000. There would have been grumbling as people expected to hear these guys firmly rebuked pretty darn quick here. But when we assume that it was possible to make this kind of profit without oppressing others in the ancient world, we're mostly just fooling ourselves. We're taking our 21st century capitalistic world and we are imposing it on the ancient world, where capitalism wasn't even possible. Then came the hero of the story. The guy who buried the talent in the ground. He didn't take advantage of the poor in order to gain more wealth. He also didn't steal his master's money. He's the good guy. Yes, he disobeyed his master, but he behaved honorably in the eyes of the peasant audience. What a guy! You know, he would actually be seen more like Robin Hood compared to the other guys who would seem like the Sheriff of Nottingham. You see, there is no such thing as honest capitalism in a zero-sum economy. I can't get richer unless you get poorer, except, like I said, through agriculture. Because, I mean, if your animals have a million babies, you haven't oppressed anyone. Okay? You've got their wool, you've got the milk, you've got the products, you've got the meat if you want to go there. It's just, yeah. Agriculture was honorable. Everything else was stealing, pretty much. I mean, obviously, if an artisan did something, they were going to get paid. That's different. But it was less honorable in the ancient world to be a carpenter or a stonemason, or especially a merchant and Lord forbid an innkeeper, than to work honestly on the land. That was the height of honorably making money back then, even among Roman senators. This is funny. Roman senators. Okay, even though they were they could be incredibly corrupt and all that stuff, still, all of their publicly making money was all through land wealth and agriculture. If they would do merchanting, which they did it through middlemen on the sly, and they wouldn't admit it. They wanted the money, they just didn't want to admit how they were getting it. But you know, Yeshua often told parables that went in the opposite direction from what was expected. Like the parable of the prodigal son, which we'll talk one of these days. And he was about to zing them really good with this one. Now, after a long time, the master of those servants came and settled accounts with them. After all, they were slaves, and the money was his. Therefore, all the fruits of labor were also his. He went away with the expectation that they would pursue his interests in his way, and that they would represent him properly, even if that meant robbing poor people. You know? He who had received the 5 talents came forward, bringing 5 talents more, saying, Master, you delivered to me the 5 talents. Here, I have made 5 talents more. His master said to him, Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. I can hear the snorts of the audience. Psh, typical rich pig. So thrilled that his jerk slave robbed his neighbors. Rewards the guy. Ha! But just wait to see what Adonai has in store for them both. Oh, Yeshua, come on. We want to hear what God's going to do to this guy. Yeah. Things don't always work out. We're coming up on the break here. But so often, Yeshua's parables, little diversion here, they will go against the culture. And a lot of his parables were told by other people, but with different endings. Because, you know, Yeshua was, you know, the first century was a time, it says in the Talmud, of gratuitous hatred, of racial, ethnic, awful prejudice, just you name it. And so their values were very different from ours, who live in the shadow of the cross in the world that Yeshua created by his death, burial, resurrection, and the new creation. So I will be back in like 3 minutes. Hi, I'm Tyler Dawn Rosenquist, and welcome back to this week's Character in Context. We've been talking about the parable of the talents with respect to the ongoing theme of the end of Matthew 24 through the end of Matthew 25, where we were commanded to therefore be ready, for we do not know when our master returns. And these four parables describe in increasing detail what Yeshua expects from us in his absence, how we are to live. And the parable of the talents is fun because it did not read to the ancient audience the way it reads to us. And so we've been going through that, and we're going to just jump right back into it. So we're with the second servant here, and starting in Matthew 25, verse 22, "And he also who had the two talents came forward, saying, 'Master, you delivered to me two talents. Here, I made two talents more.' His master said to him, 'Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master.' Again, same outcome. The servant was only judged based on doing his utmost according to his own abilities, which is why people are often tempted to see the talents as abilities. But that argument falls apart in context. Who has ever heard of God giving us abilities according to our abilities? No, this is about being given resources to use according to our abilities. But now we get to the popular hero who was seen as the good guy by the poor audience gathered around Yeshua here. He who had also received one talent came forward saying, 'Master, I knew you were a hard man, reaping what you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. So I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here, you have what's yours.' This response would have met with the crowd's overwhelming approval. Not with our capitalistic contempt, and I say that as a diehard capitalist myself. The audience would have believed, one, that this slave was exactly right about his master being a hard man, obviously reaping where he did not sow, and gathering where he scattered no seed. And in the first century world, where people were losing their land left and right to wealthier people when they defaulted on loans, and changes to the law had made it possible not to return property in the Jubilee. And eliminate debt. So the loans weren't being canceled, okay? And the Romans were, wealthy Jews, and especially the Romans were snatching up people's lands. You know, this is exactly what would happen. You know, people who were in debt would reap their own fields only to have to give most of it away in the form of tithes, taxes, and repayment of loans, and they could only do it for so long before they lost everything they had. This was a common story. You know, two, it would have been considered honorable to refuse to use the master's money to rob his neighbors. There was nothing considered wrong in Jewish culture with burying your money in order to protect it. It was considered wisdom. It is only in our capitalist mindset where we see getting back exactly what you gave someone to be somehow bad. The slave had not robbed his master, he simply hadn't made him any profit. But mouthing off to his master wasn't very bright either. Let's just be clear about that. That's probably why Yeshua's audience would have enjoyed that part so much. Verse 26, "But his master answered him, 'You wicked and slothful servant, you knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I scattered no seeds? Then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers, and at my coming, I should have received what was my own with interest.'" And you know, you'd notice that he doesn't even deny. that he reaps where he has not sown and gathered where he scatters no seeds. That is the world of tenant farmers in the ancient world. Wealthy people own the land. Tenant farmers paid to work the land and hopefully make enough money, or I mean enough food to live on. But, you know, so much of what they made went to the people who owned the land. So this is tenant farmers. Oh, and if there was a famine, if there was anything, well, they just kicked off the land because now all of a sudden they're defaulting on their loans. They could get sold into slavery, a whole bunch of different things. Now, as far as getting his money back with interest, he was probably talking about investing with money changers, which wouldn't have actually oppressed anyone and was providing a valuable service in the Roman Empire. So the only honorable option was the at least option. But he accuses the slave of being wicked and lazy, and that is where this parable ties in with the others that we've discussed over the past couple weeks. A slave is never his own man, but instead an extension of his master. Which is what becomes clear when we get to the punchline. Verse 28. So take the talent from him and give it to him who has 10 talents. For to everyone who has will more be given, and he will have an abundance. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. And cast the worthless servant into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. His master was greedy and grasping, yes. But the guy who buried the money is judged here to be a worthless servant because he didn't do what we are all commanded to do while waiting for the return of our master. Waiting judgment. Which is, you know, faithfully represent him until he comes. The crowd firmly in the camp of the slave entrusted with one talent was forgetting that no slave is his own man, not him and not us. We, like the three slaves in this parable, are members of a household. Fortunately, we're members of the household of God, and we must represent our master's interests, period, not this guy. Not a wicked master. You know, yes, the master was a jerk. And he was punished for failing to do as he was commanded and entrusted to do. I mean, the servant, his servant was punished. You know, that's the lesson out of this. And it has nothing to do with the slaves who had an evil master. That was just the story that drew the audience in. They would have been rapt. They would have been like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? His evil master's going to get it and his stupid slaves. You know, remember that parables are paintings, not snapshots. Paintings can be fantastical while photographs show us reality. Yeshua would often present an unrealistic scenario in order to present something that was true. The truth was that in his master's eyes, the slave was wicked because he wasn't looking out for his master's best interest while he was away. He wasn't prospering his kingdom. Let's put it that way, okay? He had the ability to do better and to turn a profit, and even an honest profit, but he decided not to because maybe he resented that his master got profits through dishonest means, taking what others had earned for himself. So instead of doing what he could, what was good, he chose to do nothing. And doing nothing is never an option that is available to us in our master's absence. So now let's go back to the beginning and see what was presented as admirable about the first two slaves. Verse 15, to one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, to each according to his ability. Then he went away. He who had received 5 talents went at once and traded with them, and he made 5 talents more. So also he who had the two talents made 2 talents more. But he who had received the 1 talent went and dug in the ground and hid his master's money. First of all, the master gave zero instructions whatsoever. Did you ever notice that? He didn't say, go invest this, make money, whatever. No. He gave them the resources according to their abilities and left. But slaves know their master. As the third slave would foolishly reveal later, these guys knew what kind of master they served, and the first went at once and engaged in trade, which was considered a shameful occupation. Seriously, like I keep saying, this wasn't a capitalistic society. Being a merchant was not respected because you weren't making anything yourself. You were buying low and selling high, which was not, you know, it wasn't respected. You could sell your own stuff. That was respected, but not somebody else's stuff. No, you know, merchants were suspicious characters, although not as bad as innkeepers, because they sold but did not produce themselves, which meant that they were somehow taking advantage of both their suppliers and their customers. They were subverting the God-given order. But this slave was doing what his master would do, making money even through disreputable means. But it's the at once part of this equation that makes the slave the picture of a great disciple. He knew his master's wishes and went out and did them immediately and turned a huge profit of 100%. The second slave, quote unquote, also went out, very much less emphatic than the at once servant. But he also turned a 100% profit, not too shabby. The third slave went and hid his master's talent away, knowing full well the kind of man his master was and describing it later in no uncertain terms. In fact, when he told his master what he knew about him, he said, "Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed, so I was afraid." "Master, I know you're a crook and a jerk, so I was afraid of you." His master was astounded to hear this. Not at the description, but at the slave's lack of true fear. His slave knew his expectations without being told, just like the rest of them. And yet he purposefully did not fulfill his wishes. It seems to me that he was so afraid of losing what his master had given him that he did nothing with it. Sounds a lot like the gift of life God gave us. I mean, even apart from eternal life, are we so afraid of losing our lives that we run for the hills, hide ourselves away, and do nothing to invest our lives in the Father's business? Now, I want to look at another example. Extreme example, actually. Nazi Germany. Look at how the Nazis served their master, Adolf Hitler. Now let's look at how, you know, Christians, in the midst of it, served or didn't serve God. Some of them took all their resources according to their abilities and according to their faithfulness, their trustworthiness, and worked against the Nazis by hiding Jews, the disabled, etc. Anyone who was being persecuted and shipped off to camps. But how many just decided to sit and wait it out? How many just did nothing? They didn't cooperate with the Nazis, but they sure didn't use what they had to help out the oppressed either. They were quite literally worthless slaves. And I'm not saying I would have done anything differently. I just don't know. Not everyone is a Corrie ten Boom, Irena Sendler, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, but I think we're all called to be somewhat like them, according to our abilities. You know, they obviously were at the top of the ability scale. You know, compare them with Oskar Schindler, who saved many, but in the end knew that he could have saved so many others. But he loved money, even though he did end up, you know, going broke. But it held him back. Now, God gives each of us abilities and resources. What are we going to do with them? Are we hoarding and hiding what is ours? Or are we using it to reap a profit for our master? You know, sometimes we forget that Yeshua was speaking to an audience who wasn't even middle class, because there was no middle class. To use what they had meant they might not have even enough for themselves. Yeshua was calling them to a radical kind of life, and he's calling us to a radical kind of life, too. Oh, man, that reminds me of something I read last night that I gotta share real quick. Oh, in one of Mother Teresa's books, she wrote about a family, a need was brought before her, a family with like 6 children. They were starving to death. This was in Calcutta. And so she got rice. She got enough rice for the family, and she took it to them. Immediately, the mother took half the rice and disappeared. And when she came back, you know, it was made clear to Mother Teresa that, I can't remember how, but she found out that this mother had taken half of the rice that she needed to feed her own children and gave it to their neighbors who also had starving children. Wow. Wow. You know, jeez. And we don't even want to give our extra money, right? If we have extra money, we want to spend it on something fun. When we're all fed, right? Have our bills paid. So, but let's go to the punchline of the parable that contrasts and compares the kingdom life with a life here in this world. So take the talent from him and give it to the one who has 10 talents. For to everyone who has, will more be given, and he will have an abundance. But from the one who does not, even what he has will be taken away. And cast the worthless servant into the outer darkness. In that place will be the weeping and gnashing of teeth. The audience would have rolled their eyes if they did that sort of thing culturally. I don't know. Yes, in the world as we know it, the people who have much, you know, they just keep getting more. It's a fact of life. To the one who was given little, you know, he had it taken away and given to the guy who has the most. This absolutely is the way things have been throughout the ages. But in the kingdom, we have a different sort of economy. A poor man can be rich in Messiah, in spiritual things, in true eternal wealth. Because of this, we can immediately or right away jump up and serve the master according to the resources we have been given, whatever they are. And we will be held accountable according to our abilities. Someone who has been given the gift of hospitality is not going to be judged by the same criteria of service that someone with the gift of healing will be, or someone who has the ability to perform deliverance, or someone who can teach. The parable tells us to get up and get busy doing what we are called to do, not what everyone else is called to do. There are so many people out there squandering their master's resources because they think that what they're equipped to do isn't good enough or flashy enough. But honestly, if I'm hungry, I don't care if you're a teacher or if you can work healing miracles. I need a sandwich and maybe a place to sleep. If the people who are equipped to do that job are spending their time on the internet preaching, they are wasting their time. One, they aren't called to it, and so they will either be unsuccessful or they'll have to resort to worldly methods to get and maintain an audience. And two, God needs people who can make sandwiches. No, that's not a joke either. It is a more pressing need for those who are hungry, who aren't going to care about the gospel when they're starving. We all have our kingdom work, and not everyone is meant to be in full-time ministry. For many, it's a waste of their God-given resources and abilities. But, you know, we have these worldly ideas about what God wants from us, ideas that have almost zero basis in reality. And it's a disaster because we don't respect our gifts, as well as not respecting our weaknesses either. When we're doing somebody else's job, we are hiding our master's talent in the dirt. It's as simple as that. We're not representing him. Now, Corrie Ten Boom, if you've read The Hiding Place, and I hope you have, she had organizational skills and a very clever mind. But she worked side by side with grocers and carpenters and government officials to shelter Jews in Nazi-occupied Poland. Or Holland, sorry. Irena Sendler had medical training and experience as a social worker. But she could do nothing without the faithful Catholic families who took in the smuggled Jewish children at the risk of their own children's lives. Oskar Schindler had a factory and a ton of money. We have what we have, and we do with it according to our abilities. That right there is the parable of the talents. A life that our good master rewards, and if we do not, if we ignore our resources and refuse to be grateful for and use our God-given abilities, we will find ourselves weeping and gnashing our teeth in the outer darkness. We'll find ourselves rejected. We may find ourselves in the world to come, but so far from the throne that we can barely hear the praises being sung to our king. Oh, and then they'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And speaking of somebody who is doing amazing things with their God-given abilities, one of my dearest friends, her name is Dr. Dina Dye, and she has a ministry called foundationsintorah.com, and she is the author of quite a few books. The Temple Revealed in Creation, The Temple Revealed in the Garden, that kind of thing. But I'm not going to talk about that today. I want to talk about her On Fire Prayer initiative. And it's just blown up. I'll tell you, when it's like sometimes we have these seminal moments in our lives. And when New York passed that horrible abortion bill, at this point, it's going to be about 5 months ago when this airs. Dina just, all of a sudden, all of the things she's done all of her life just coalesced, and she became this on-fire political animal through organizing prayer nationwide, and they've got chapters in every state now. I hope, I can't remember if it's onfireprayer.org or onfireprayer.com, but you know, you can find it, and her name is Dina Dye, D-I-N. A-H-D-Y-E. You can also, I'm sure you can find links to it from foundationsintorah.com. And I will put the links up when I put this up on my podcast channel. She's just using, she's not burying her resources. She has this audience that's a worldwide audience, and she's using it to fight the scourge of things like abortion, the moral issues that are just plaguing our communities here in the United States, but I am hoping it'll go worldwide, because America is not the only country to be facing these horrible things. But you know, if you are a prayer warrior, if you are somebody who is on fire for these issues too, boy, I just absolutely encourage you to hook up with her organization. And if there isn't a chapter in your state, well, maybe that is something you have the resources and the abilities to help out with, because I think they've got, I can't remember how many, a lot of states, but they don't have all of them. They need more. Anyway, so there are so many ways we can serve our Lord. So many different ways. And I hope this I hope this was edifying for you. I hope this taught you a lot about ways to be prepared. Next week, we'll be talking about the parable of the sheep and the goats and finishing out this series, unless I find something else to teach on. Take care.